My name is Sami Awad, and I'm the director of an organization called Holy Land Trust, which is located in Bethlehem. And I've seen that the best way to explain the work that we are doing is to briefly start on a personal history, because for me, where I am now and the work I'm doing has a lot to do with my family history and how that struggle as a family has affected my life and the choices that I have made in my life. And I'll try to be brief about this because I would like to talk more about the work in nonviolence that we are engaged in as an organization. Even though I wasn't born at that time, but my personal history began like many other people in that region in 1948. In 1948, when the war broke out, our family was greatly affected by that war because my grandfather was killed in the war. He was killed in a neighborhood in Jerusalem called the Musrara, where my father's family comes from. And he was killed as he was trying to raise a white flag on top of his house to protect his family. He had a wife and 7 children. The oldest was 12 years old and the youngest was a 2-month-year-old daughter. And Musrara was the area where there was shooting happening between the two forces, and their house was in the middle. And the only way he knew to protect his family from not being completely killed was to put this white flag. And he was actually killed as he placed the white flag on top of his house. It took his children a few hours to be able to reach him, to find out first what happened to him, and then to pull his body down and bury it inside the house itself. But the situation for this family did not just end with that tragedy. A few days later, the Jewish army troops took over Musrara, and my father's family was evicted. They were kicked out of their home. Even though that neighborhood, like many other neighborhoods throughout Palestine at that time, was one that had Jews, Christians, and Muslims live in it. And my father talks about stories when he was 9 years old at that time, before that, when he would play with the Jewish children and the Muslim children in the same street, and nobody looked at the other in any discrimination at all. But now they became refugees, part of the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians now that live, hundreds of thousands at that time, that were kicked out of their villages, homes, and communities. And you could just imagine that family and that thin line of choosing hatred, anger, and revenge, which are fully justified, to choosing a path of hope and looking forward. And we always thank God for my grandmother, who continuously kept a message of hope alive in her children, and always telling them not to take revenge for what happened to your father and what has happened to us in becoming refugees. The family moved to Bethlehem, where they grew up. And because my grandmother couldn't take care of 7 children, she put them in orphan homes. So my father and his siblings grew up in very terrible situation in orphan homes that were very terrible conditions. My father talks of examples of owning one pair of shoe for 6 and 7 years, even as his foot grew as a child. Of course, the shoe did not grow, but it was tearing apart, and nails was the only way that he could keep that one pair of shoe in one piece, at least. But he was blessed to have been adopted by an American family. When he finished high school, this family took him to the U.S., where he continued his education and then moved and lived in Kansas City, where he stayed there and worked there for many years. Towards the end of the 60s, he returned back to Jerusalem because his mother was insisting that he had to meet somebody. And you know how mothers are when they insist you have to meet somebody that I think is right for you and perfect for you. And he hesitated, but at the end he accepted and went with his mother to Gaza to meet a neighbor of her cousin who was living in Gaza. And I don't say this in our stories, but I just like to point out that my grandmother's cousin was Muslim. And I just wanted just to show you that even within Palestinian families, having Christian and Muslim relatives in one family is not strange to us, and historically has not been strange to us. So they went and visited this cousin, who pointed out the beautiful blonde woman in the balcony next door, and my father went head over heels. He had to have her without even knowing who she was. Of course, when they approached this beautiful blonde woman, she laughed it off and rejected this person who, because he had been living in the U.S. for so long, his Arabic now was broken. He comes back with a big afro and with these big sideburns, you know, we're talking 60s and 70s, and bell-bottom pants, and he's walking around, you know, doing his best sort of attractive move to this beautiful girl, and she just, I mean, look at this clown, you know, and she completely rejects him. But, you know, part of nonviolence is persistence, and my father persisted and persisted, and she finally gave up and married him. And they moved back to Kansas City, where I was born. So I was born in Kansas City, and 6 months after I was born, we moved to Bethlehem, back to Bethlehem, because my father got a job offer to head an orphanage school. And he did not take him 2 minutes to say yes to that job offer, and it was an opportunity for him to give to children who were living in very difficult lives, to give them what he had missed growing up in an orphanage school. And it's one in a town called Beit Jala, which was run by the Mennonites at that time. But growing up in that area, I grew up like all Palestinian children. And growing up as a Palestinian child means we grew up in times of occupation. Growing up where our only experience of Israelis were soldiers and settlers. That's everything we saw. And both of these groups had guns, had weapons, and both of them were violent towards us. We grew up fearing them just by seeing them, but also, I would say, fearing them because we were warned by our parents to run away from them, to be afraid of them, to not interfere with them. If they ask you anything, listen to them. Don't disobey them. And obedience is a big issue in terms of, you know, living under suppressive systems. I saw how the soldiers would come into the school on many occasions to try to arrest somebody, and how they were violent, how my father was violently abused by soldiers who were just maybe a few years older than me. And this older man that I looked up to and respected was bowing his head in front of them and would listen to anything they would say. And he would say, "Yes, sir," to an 18 or 19 year old soldier, just to keep the other children safe in his school. But for me, there was something wrong. This could not be life. This could not be what was meant to live on this earth. This was not what it should be for me as a child growing up. But I also knew all that time, because we grew up also in this family where the idea of compassion and forgiveness was very much entrenched in our family, that also violence was not an option for me. It was not even, you know, I remember it was even very few times where I would even play this cowboy Indian game. It just never even felt right doing that for me. So I always grew up in this challenge of what to do about it. I have to do something, I should do something, but what to do about it? And the person who influenced me greatly and really gave me the answer on what to do about it was an uncle of mine who had been living in the U.S. but had returned in the early 80s with a strong message for the Palestinian community. And the message was to organize nonviolent direct action and protests against the occupation, to mobilize the Palestinian community in a nonviolent movement. Now, as Palestinians, I always like to make it clear that we are proud and always say that we have a history of engaging in nonviolence. That goes back even as far as the time of the British Mandate. But what Mubarak Awad came with was the idea of how can we organize and mobilize in a in a real, proactive, strategic, nonviolent movement against the occupation. And he established a center in Jerusalem, which was called the Palestinian Center for the Study of Nonviolence. And as a young teenager, that was the answer for me. I loved going to the center, activities, protests, peaceful demonstrations, very empowering activities, even for a young teenager who now was doing activities where sort of this barrier of fear was starting to break down. I could now look at an Israeli soldier. I could face an Israeli soldier and not have the fear that I had before, because now I had something, I had a message. I was able to do it in confidence. And the center would do many activities. And one of the things that I remember very well about one of the activities that we did continuously was when my uncle, at that time, for example, raising the Palestinian flag was not just illegal by military rules. You would get imprisoned, if not even shot and killed, if some soldier sees you raising a Palestinian flag in any Palestinian area. So the way my uncle would address this issue was through balloons. So he would bring balloons with the different colors of the Palestinian flag, and these are the things that we raise in demonstrations. And we're children carrying balloons. But if you look from far away, you see the colors of the Palestinian flag. So these are just some of the activities that would take place within the community. A big thing that was active at that time in the center was, for example, planting trees also in lands that were going to be confiscated. We're at Scott Kennedy's center. Maybe people know about Scott Kennedy, the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz. And it was incredible. He pulled out posters from the early 80s that my uncle had produced about, it wasn't even a call to boycott Israeli products, because that was very illegal at that time. But it was a call on supporting and strengthening the Palestinian economy. And these posters would have all of the Palestinian symbols in them without referring to the actual events that are happening. In one poster, for example, there's a little house in the middle of the poster that has the Palestinian flag drawn inside the house. So you look at the poster from far and you see a regular poster, but there's a little Palestinian flag, even at that time when these were considered illegal. In 1987, the first Palestinian Intifada broke out, uprising. It was the popular revolt against the occupation. And for me and many Palestinians, we saw nonviolence being implemented on a mass scale in this Intifada, in this uprising. I'm not going to say it was all nonviolent. I'm not going to say it was all violent. But it was a popular revolt. People were doing things now. They were empowered to do things that they had never done before, to confront the structures of oppression, to say no to obedience. And this was really what the first Intifada was all about. How to say no to those military orders and rules that were controlling every aspect of our lives. My uncle was arrested in 1988. He was seen as one of the leaders of the underground leadership of the Intifada. And he was put on trial in 1988. And the Israeli High Court ruling came in to deport my uncle, to kick him out of the country because he was seen as a threat to the security of Israel. And it was a big case, and many reporters wrote about it. George Shultz, who was Secretary of State at that time, actually traveled from Washington to Tel Aviv to meet with Israeli leaders just to discuss the issue of Mubarak Awad and why the U.S. actually was trying to persuade Israel not to deport a nonviolent activist. It all failed, and he was kicked out of the country. And that, for me, was one of the biggest points in my life, where nonviolence went from what felt good, what felt nice, what felt empowering to do, to really start asking the question, what does nonviolence mean to the other side as well? And why is the other side afraid of nonviolence? And the other side here, I don't mean the Israeli people or the Jewish people. I mean the structures of occupation, the structures of oppression, the structures of the military. Why don't they want us to engage in nonviolence? And what is the threat that is in nonviolence to them? And at that time, I decided I'm going to commit my life to studying and engaging in nonviolence. That same year, I was also deported, but not by the Israeli government, by my father. I was starting to get a little bit too involved and too active for him, and he decided to kick me out of the country as well. And I couldn't resist that violently or non-violently. So I was back in the U.S., where I did my studies in political science and my master's degree in peace and conflict resolution, which is an international relations program at American University. And in 1996, I returned back to my home, to Palestine, at a time when we had something called a peace process happening between Palestinians and Israelis, known as the Oslo peace process. A peace process that had brought hope to many people on both sides, that finally we're going to resolve this, finally we're going to negotiate an end to this bloodshed that has destroyed both communities and both peoples, but a peace process that was slowly, slowly failing and deteriorating, where the situation for Palestinians had actually become worse during the time of the peace process than even during the times of the occupation itself. And I'll just, there are many examples of this, but I'll just give one example, which maybe all of you have heard and know about, which even the U.S. government is critical of, putting it mildly, and that's how the U.S. policy is, which is the issue of settlements. As we were negotiating peace, as we were negotiating the foundation and the premise of peace, which is two states for two peoples living side by side in peace, the Israeli government during those years was engaging in a campaign to confiscate as much land as possible and to build as many settlements as possible on Palestinian land. Settlements are illegal. This is the word, international law, UN resolutions, even U.S. policy considers settlements, moving citizens, civilians into land that are occupied by a foreign force, is considered illegal. And it's not just for us an issue of legality, it's more an issue of a project that is detrimental for any real peace to happen in that region. The number of settlers more than doubled just in the years of the peace process, from 200,000 settlers to over 420,000 settlers in the years of negotiations. Now the number is over 550,000 settlers. And most of these settlements are strategically located in areas that even at the time of the peace process were planned to really derail any possibility of peace, any possibility of a Palestinian state to be established in the lands of the West Bank and Gaza, which is 20% of the historic land that Palestinians said, we will just take 20%. And most of these settlements were built in and around Jerusalem. Jerusalem, which is symbolically, politically, socially, economically, religiously very important for Palestinians as well as Israelis, I would say, now became a target to just make it and maintain it as an Israeli city and not to allow any Palestinian political or social or economic establishment in that city. So while the people were hopeful for peace and wanting peace, and still, you know, even the latest polls say 70% on both sides still want peace, there are forces that did not want peace. Everything collapsed in the year 2000. The second intifada happened in the year 2000, and things really fell into this whirlpool of absolute chaos and violence. And even as a Palestinian, I don't like to play the card of the victim, which is the card that everybody plays in our area. But I just like to say that violence has happened on both sides, and it is not an issue of how many people have been killed, because for me, at the end of the day, when a mother loses a child, she doesn't look at what number she is on the list. An Israeli mother cries as much as a Palestinian mother cries for the loss of her child. And then you fall into this mindset where violence is not to achieve any political agenda or to suppress any terrorist group, as Israel claims, but violence becomes a goal by itself, an act of retaliation and revenge. And this is what is happening now, and we're seeing happening a lot within the Palestinian community. As an organization, we felt that it was very important to bring back nonviolence again to the Palestinian resistance. We were very successful and very empowered when we did nonviolence in the first Intifada, so we should do it again as well. But there were forces that did not want nonviolence. And in our research and analysis and the way we look at the situation, we have seen that the Israeli military is one of the major forces that did not want Palestinians to engage in nonviolence again. And there was actually mass suppression in the first part of the Second Intifada of any Palestinian protesters going on the street, demonstrations very similar to the first Intifada. And there are many researches done on that. I'm not saying that the Israeli government and military wanted Palestinians to engage in violence. Some people might say that or come to that conclusion. But I would say clearly that they did not want nonviolence. They wanted violence or not violence, that's not an issue for me, but it was really an issue that there was a movement to not allow Palestinians to do nonviolence, because nonviolence really is powerful in exposing and showing the realities of what is happening on the ground. And it would show the reality of how the peace process was a failure from its onset. But it was very difficult to talk to Palestinians about nonviolence, and we were accused by many of the militant factions that we were against resistance, we were traitors, we just wanted to find a way to get back to negotiations, we wanted to hold hands with Israelis and sing Kumbaya 24 hours a day. Those were sort of the responses we got from the community, because there was a lot of anger. A lot of anger, and I would say not just against the Israeli authority, but even against the Palestinian authority itself. Everybody had failed us. Everybody had disappointed us. But for us, we persisted on this. And the change we started seeing happen within the Palestinian community was in the year 2002. In 2002, as you might remember from just this recent history, the Israeli army engaged in mass deployment of forces in different Palestinian areas. In Jenin, there was the massacre that happened in the refugee camp in Jenin. In the old city of Nablus, the army went in and more people were killed there. In Ramallah, the president was put under compound arrest at that time, President Arafat. And you may remember that he stayed there until he passed away in France. The only time he left was when he went to France and died there. In Bethlehem, everybody probably remembers, we had the siege of the Church of Nativity, 40 days and 40 nights of the Church of Nativity being under siege. But all of these actions, as violent as they were, as deadly as they were for Palestinians, also were a wake-up call for many Palestinian groups, where the idea of engaging in armed resistance, which people call violence or armed resistance, was really not achieving the political goals that we as Palestinians wanted to achieve. That there was really no land liberated in the engagement in armed resistance. It could have been this sort of tactic for retaliation and revenge, like many people claimed and still claim, but on the ground there wasn't much happening. And that's when we started seeing groups come to us, asking us and requesting of us to do trainings in nonviolence. And that training has developed and evolved over the years, where we have now reached a point where we actually get more demand for training than what we're able to meet. And across the spectrum of Palestinian groups, from political factions, we've done training with Hamas, for example. Leadership in Hamas in the north of the West Bank came to us and asked us to do training in nonviolence for 20 of their men. It was all men at that time. Organizations, women's groups, village councils, and most of our work is with villages at this time. Because part of what has happened as well, again, in this process of separating Palestinians and controlling Palestinians, is the construction of the wall that has taken place in and around Palestinian areas. Now, of course, Israel claims that the wall is for security reasons, And as Palestinians, we say, if it is for security reasons, then there is nothing better than to make it a border wall. Make it a border wall on the green line, which is the legitimate legal line, and you could build whatever wall you want, and as high as you want it, on the international borders of Palestine and Israel. Only 5% of the wall is actually built on the green line. 95% of the wall is built in Palestinian areas, going deep in some areas, 10 kilometers into Palestinian areas, which clearly shows that the wall is not just a security wall. And actually, it was the person who designed the wall who in a recent interview, an Israeli, who in a recent interview said that the wall was intended only to be 10% for security reasons. And the 90% was for demographic and environmental reasons. Demographic meaning creating what we are seeing now, which are the bamboo stands where the Palestinians are living, and putting the settlements, which are illegal, as I said, on the other side of the wall. And environmental, meaning where are the most important thing for people living in that area? Water. Where are the water cisterns and aquifers, underground water resources? And if you take two maps, one of the wall and one of the water basins, you will see how the wall actually comes and turns around these areas as well. So there's more of the intention of the wall than just security, and this is something that people need to know about. But the wall is really destroying, even if we accept these arguments, the most fact is that the wall is destroying any possibility for a Palestinian state in the future to be viable. Once the wall is complete, Palestinians will probably get around 40 to 45% of the West Bank. So we were talking 20% of historic Palestine. Now it is 40% of the 20%, which means about 8% of that historic, which in reality you cannot build a sustainable state on. One thing that we are engaged in is activities with villagers in resisting the wall and how it's being built in their areas. Villages that have never had a history of engaging in any violence at all are the ones that are being targeted. They are losing more of their land than anybody else. In the Bethlehem area, in the southern Bethlehem, we work with 9 villages where they will lose about 60% of their agricultural land once the wall is built. And it is incredible how they are so committed to nonviolence as a way of resisting this. And we have Palestinians, internationals, and Israelis who are working together in resisting this wall. One thing I always want to make it clear in every presentation and everything I give is that never look at this conflict as a black and white conflict. It is not the poor Palestinians who are the goody-gooders and the bad, evil Israelis, or the bad Palestinian terrorists and the poor Israelis who are suffering from the attacks of Palestinians. We need to recognize and always realize that there is good and bad on both sides, and there are forces that do not want peace on both sides. But it's only a process that moves forward that peace can really be achieved, and those voices of extremism can be suppressed on both ends. Nonviolence is taking place within the Palestinian areas. But I cannot stand here and declare that there is a nonviolent movement happening in Palestine. We are seeing more Palestinians interested in nonviolence, less and less criticism, I could say almost to zero criticism of nonviolence, as I said before, of being collaborators or being Mossad agents or being traitors to the resistance. This has almost ended completely. And more people want to learn about nonviolence and more people want to engage in nonviolence. But what we are doing now, a lot of the nonviolence that's taking place is what we call reactionary nonviolence, people reacting to what the occupation is doing to us. For nonviolence to become successful, we need to engage in what is called proactive nonviolence. and this is what the first Intifada was about, and this is what we hope the third Intifada will be about. A proactive movement of the people in rejecting the structures of oppression that we face, never targeting the physical, the psychological, and even the spiritual value of any other person on the other side. It deals with the structures of oppression that, for me, I would say, are suppressing the Israeli community as much as they are suppressing the Palestinian community as well. It's a long process, it's a long way, but, you know, I was here 4 years ago and I was talking with a message of hope. But now I'm 4 years later, and as difficult as the situation has become, as close to the edge of complete disaster where we are, I'm actually more hopeful now than I was 4 years ago in the power of the people to make the changes in their lives. And with this, I'll hand over to Bakta. Thank you.
Sammy always leaves the clock up here so that I can do the, like, how much time I actually have left. That's all right, I'll be quick.
No, thank you.
No. So I will also start with a little bit of information about who I am, not necessarily because it's, my stomach is also really growling, so I hope you can't hear it. Okay, I'll stand really far away just in case. Not because it's particularly interesting or says all that much about, you know, the situation over there, but people often ask who I am and why I ended up standing in front of people talking like I know what I'm talking about, which you'll see at the end how, what percentage I'm just full of, you know what. So, I grew up in New Mexico in a relatively Jewish, really Jewish, relatively progressive household. And I was bat mitzvahed, confirmed, if that means anything to anybody. And I always use as a sort of measurement of how Jewish I am that my twin sister is about to be ordained as a rabbi next week. So if that works, you can figure it out from there, how we were raised. And yes, we do get along quite well. Thank you for asking. So that's where I grew up, and I grew up in a household that was full of progressive values. My father was an anti-war activist in the 60s. My mother was an a civil rights activist, anti-segregationist activist, also in the 50s and 60s in the South. So I really grew up with this real sense of social justice, and a lot of that came from, you know, growing up Jewish, frankly. That's what a lot of progressive Jews in this country are raised in. And I was also raised as a staunch Zionist. I went to the region for the first time in 1998 on a Zionist youth trip that lots of teenagers do, like for their senior year in high school, where you are involved, a boat from Athens to Haifa, where we reenacted the Exodus. Somebody's nodding as though they've, like, yeah, I went on that, or I had a niece or nephew that went on that. And you live on a kibbutz, you paint playgrounds, and you pick avocados, and you're really, you know, you come away from it with an attachment to the land and an attachment to the people. And I know that at some point I had to have gone into the West Bank, because I know places that I went that I have pictures of that are in the West Bank. But I would have had no idea. They make it intentional that you don't know as a young person that there are other people living in the same area, that it's the same geographical location. It is not two separate countries. We talked about at the time, 1998, when we went up into the Galilee and the Golan Heights, we talked about Lebanon, and all of the conversation about any conflict in the region was about Israel and Lebanon. And I knew that there had been a peace process. I remember Rabin. In fact, I remember being in Hebrew school when Rabin was assassinated and people were crying. And I was like, wow, you know, that's And I was 13, so I was really dramatic, so I really wanted to, like, you know, be part of the sympathy, even though I didn't really actually know who Rabin was. So I was, like, you know, going out and really, you know, feeling the emotion of it, even though no idea. But that's where I came from. And it took from 1998 until really 2003. 2003 is when I went back as a Palestine solidarity activist. And how I got there in between 1998 and 2003, right smack in the middle, is kind of this important event in my life and probably the entire world's life, which is that I went as a student to New York University. I was in New York City for September 11th. And I was actually very close to the World Trade Center because there's a NYU dorm 5 blocks away. And until that moment, when I went to college, I was sort of progressive. I did anti-sweatshop things, which is the big thing for college activism in the early 2000s. And we, you know, I went to some pro-union demonstrations, and I kind of had this progressive look, but I totally refused to talk about Israel. I thought that any progressive person that wanted to talk to me about what was happening in Israel, Palestine, this is 2000 by this point. This is, you know, the start of the second Intifada, and I just kept saying that anybody who wanted to address the issue of Palestinian civilians or Palestinian rights were crazy, they were anti-Semitic, they just didn't know, they hadn't been there like I had been there, they hadn't been raised in the family that I had been raised in, that was, you know, the granddaughter of somebody who escaped the Holocaust. There's just no way a conversation could happen about it, and if they had something to say about it, it was just wrong. I agree with those people on 99% of political issues, but not about Israel, and I wouldn't talk about it. And what is interesting is, unlike a vast majority of this country, September 11th really pushed me to have much more sympathy and compassion for Arabs and Muslims. And the reason was because of Zionists. And what happened was, there were, in New York City, by October of 2001, there were pickets and marches and demonstrations of people demanding that there not be a massive bombing campaign in Afghanistan. There were people in New York City that were saying, please, for God's sake, you know, don't, as Bush was getting up on the rubble and saying, we're going to smoke them out, there were lots of people, tens of thousands of people, in fact, in New York City that were saying, you know, we're the ones who actually experienced this firsthand, and even we can see the absurdity of connecting this attack on the World Trade Center with a country across the world and the civilians that live there. And so we were having marches and, you know, small demonstrations, and they were mostly being organized by Arab Students United and the Muslim Islam Center at our university, cultural clubs. And, you know, most of the progressive students were going to them. And we would stand outside with little signs. And, you know, that was it. We weren't confrontational. But the reaction to what we were doing was so astounding to me that I just had to figure out what was going on. Because there was a very powerful, I won't even say Zionist group, there was a very powerful right-wing, pro-Israel, extremist Zionist group on campus called Torch Pack. The torch is the symbol of NYU, pack as in APAC. So it's like they're trying to be the NYU version of APAC. So that's where they were at. And they were counter-demonstrating anything that the Arab Students United were doing. They were raiding the Arab Students United office. They were vandalizing their doors. They were breaking the windows of the office. They were breaking the windows of any display, like clubs. I mean, it was just horrendous stuff. We couldn't. And I was sitting there going, "What in the world is going on here? Who are these people?" And it sort of escalated to a point where they rented a Humvee that was camouflage. I put an Israeli flag on the top of it and got a bullhorn and, leaning out the window screaming death to the Arabs, ran the Humvee into a demonstration, a standing demonstration that I was in. And I was like, that is not my team. Those are not my people. I don't know what's going on here exactly. I haven't quite figured it out, but that is certainly not where I'm at. And I was very lucky to have a good professor and lots of progressive people that had stuck around me, even through all that time of not being willing to talk about Israel or Palestine, that suddenly were very willing to talk to me about Israel and Palestine once I kind of was willing to have a conversation without screaming at them. And slowly but surely, I kind of decided that I was going to have to get a different perspective on it, and in the end, ended up working with a group called Jews Against the Occupation in New York City, which were a fantastic group that from the very beginning, when it wasn't popular, when it was not, you know, when they were getting death threats, they were out in the street by the end of 2001, 2002, saying, not only are we Jewish and against the occupation, but it is okay for other Jews to be Jewish and against the occupation, and everybody should join us. And they were picketing the Israeli Day Parade and doing amazing stuff. So nothing but good stuff to say about them. And one of them took me to Palestine, and I went for 2 weeks. And I just happened to be in the coolest place ever at the time, which was at the very end of 2003, which was when the height, I would say, of the anti-wall movement, which was a popular resistance against the construction of the wall, was going on. 2003, 2004 was, there were demonstrations every day across the region, nonviolent, men, women, and children, international Israeli and Palestinian. They were just amazing. And I ended up, by sheer luck, in a town called Budrus. Has anybody heard of Budrus? Yay! Nora's been to Budrus with me. Sorry. Yay! Okay. Has anybody heard of Bilayin, just out of curiosity? Yeah, lots more. Okay. See, Budrus was before Bilayin. Budrus actually won, and won without a court case. Budrus for 3 months, and I just like to give them credit for it. Budrus for the 3 months did demonstrations in which the entire population of their village went out to where the construction was happening. Hamas, Fatah, PFLP, women, men, they were going to stop the wall. And it was a particular situation in which they were, the village itself was very close to the green line, so it was incredibly absurd that the fence slash wall was being built on their land that was going to steal like 70% instead of just being built on the green line. But they went beyond that. They were demanding that the wall or the fence be built on the green line. They were saying, how dare you decide, you meaning the Israeli military, how dare you decide who is safe or unsafe, you know, based on our village, without talking to any of us, it wasn't part of a negotiation, it wasn't part of an agreement, there wasn't any kind of, you know, you've just decided that you're not only going to build something that's going to create a border, but you're going to divide us from people that we historically have had a relationship with. Because, you know, pre-90s, there was crossover over the green line all the time. You know, so you're dividing us from historic relationships. And not only that, but you're also just trying to take our land, which is just crazy. So, and they just won. I mean, they demonstrated for 3 months, and instead of losing 70% of their land, they lost a few meters in one section. And they did it without, you know, going through the courts, which they're very proud of, though other places since then have also won in conjunction with court cases. And I just happened to be there, right? And I was being inspired by these great, the leader of Budrus is this fantastic man who's just inspirational and talks about, you know, how he wanted internationals and Israelis, especially Jewish internationals and Israelis, to come and stand with the Palestinians, not in front and not behind in the marches, but next to them, that this was a Palestinian struggle. The Palestinians needed to be making the decisions and empowering themselves to take on what what they needed and what their future was going to look like, but that they knew that they wanted to do it with other people as well. And so I stayed for 2 weeks. I left for a month, and I came back and stayed for 3 months. And the next place that I went, also engaging in nonviolent direct action and demonstrations against the wall, was a place called Bidu. And the second day I got there, 5 people were killed in a demonstration, Palestinians. And I was not at the demonstration, which is one of the reasons why people ended up getting killed, because internationals got there late. Talk about guilt. So, sorry, sometimes you just have to laugh at these things. And so I really learned that my role as an American Jew was not simply just to learn and educate myself, which was important. It was a good first step, good job. But also to be able to be willing to do something about it. And the direction I took, mostly out of strategy and necessity, was one of participating in popular nonviolent direct action and resistance. Because that's the one I can participate in. And it's the one where children can participate, and women can participate, and all men can participate. It's not one based on, means, how much money you have, where you live. Anybody can do this kind of nonviolent resistance, and that's what was really attractive to me, and I thought that was great. So in 2006, after a little stint of not being able to get in, I helped a group of Palestinians start an organization called the Palestine Solidarity Project, which is what I work with now. And we do a variety of different things, because one of the things we recognized by 2006 was that we needed to address not only just, hey, let's organize some demonstrations that are all kind of maybe connected to each other, maybe not, maybe just a flare-up here or a flare-up there, and we'll demonstrate in this area for a month, and then you'll never hear about us again, or, but we really wanted to do something that was sustainable, something that would continue and grow. So we developed a program of nonviolent support for nonviolent resistance in the region of Hebron, and then we also started doing economic self-sufficiency projects that were really about, we're not an aid agency by any means, like we don't do charity, and we can't be an aid agency because we're not actually skilled enough or have enough money to do it, frankly. But we wanted to develop programs in which average Palestinians that had been really disenfranchised by this process of political involvement could see that they were getting something out of working with us, in addition to us just being like, don't you want to come to a demonstration and possibly get arrested? Doesn't that in some other village that's not actually your land, doesn't that sound really enticing? And so we also do projects. We have a greenhouse project where we do permaculture greenhouses, and people get trained in greenhouse maintenance, because greenhouses are the new big thing in Palestine. A women's embroidery project, all kinds of things, really to address how can internationals come in and support Palestinians doing what they need to be able to do in order to be empowered and proactive. So I don't, as Becca Wolf, go in and empower people. That makes no sense. There's nothing about me giving you something that somehow empowers you to do something. It's not like, yes, now I feel self-sufficient and great because somebody else did something for me. But it's really about us figuring out the skills and resources and getting the skills and resources from outside Palestine into Palestine on a grassroots level so that those folks can do what they need to do and be proactive. And I just have one more thing to say, which is I have spent now 4 or 5 days traveling around with Sammy, and I've also known Sammy and our organizations work together over in the West Bank. And what's fascinating to me is his dogmatic insistence on focusing on what can we do? What are we going to do about it? Because I get caught up over there, totally get caught up over there, in and here, but even more so over there, in focusing on oh my God, look at the situation and how terrible it is. Look at all the wrongs that have been done. Look at all the wrongs from, you know, from, if it's not from the Israeli military who just arrested my best friend, then it's from Israeli settlers who beat up and, you know, severely injured a 75-year-old farmer. If it's not that, it's the Palestinian Authority who is attacking demonstrations against the negotiation. You know, it's, and I have been very excited and impressed and empowered by the fact that Sammy, who lives there and is helping and has a family there, certainly not nearly as privileged as I, is dogmatic about his insistence to just think about what are we going to do about it. And so that is the challenge that I leave all of us with, which is that I think we should be focusing on what are we going to do about it, and what can I do about it, and all those cool questions. That's all I have to say about that. Thank you.
I'd like to call on my colleague Lynn Gottlieb to share a few words with you.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum. What can we do about it? So many times we hear amazing information and we feel enriched and we feel empowered, and yet our speakers are not even sure whether they're leading their own communities and their own work. They're not even sure whether their plane tickets will be covered. So there is really something that we can do, and that is make a generous contribution to Holy Land Trust. I'm asking you to think about how much you pay for taxes. I'm asking you to think about how much you pay for your coffee and for your movie. And I know the Quakers live frugally and have been a long time committed to peace. But I'm asking you tonight to think about what you can contribute. $10 is not enough. It's good, but it's not enough. I would like you to think of a figure in your head, something you feel like you could contribute, and then add to that. Because we do have the resources. And it would be very helpful if you could, in fact, write a check, which is tax deductible, to Holy Land Trust. Or if you would like to contribute cash, that would also be fine. We will, if you leave your name and your address with that cash amount, we can also make sure that it is counted as cash, as a tax deductible. Some people feel uncomfortable, when people are solicited for money, but I don't, because I've been going there since 1966. And I have been part of the Palestinian Solidarity Movement such as it is since 1966. And I have been to endless conversations and endless discussions and have seen people go away in all sorts of, you know, with all sorts of ideas. But the Palestinian community is one of the most inspirational communities that I have seen around the world. And they are teaching us, and including the Quakers, what nonviolence means, not just as a spiritual dimension in silence and to think about to enrich our lives, but what it means to stand face to face with some of the greatest brutality that is possible and to still embrace life and nonviolence. And this community needs to stay on its land. This community needs help that we can provide in such a very simple way in order to continue to gather the resources, which are such a treasure and would be so lost to us if this community is continues to be dispersed. This is a world treasure, and we cannot let it go. So please tonight, if you are so moved, do make a generous contribution to Holy Land Trust. And for those of you who would like to be part of the sustainability, to sustain those of us, Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, all the people in the United States, secular people who want to resist militarism, and in so doing, make a better place for human beings, then you can continue to stay in touch with programming. You can go over, you can see for yourself, you can be involved with AFSC here, and be involved in work that sustains nonviolence, justice, and peace. So thank you very much for allowing me these 3 to 5 minutes to be slightly annoying. Please do reach within, and whatever you can would really be appreciated. Thank you. And by the way, I am about to go to Iran, so wish me luck. I'm meeting a Fellowship of Reconciliation delegation, and I will tell you about it when I get back.
Despite the appearance, as of now dedicated to Help Up, Palestine Solidarity Project, and Sammy's work.
We'll also answer any questions.
Yes, I don't want to interrupt, you know, the check writing by any means, but that was kind of a joke, people. Sorry.
Maybe give them a minute.
Okay, sorry. I will give you a minute.
Are you still ready for questions?
Well, I'll give people a minute to, you know.
So, late in their wallets. Hold on just a second there. Yes, ma'am?
I'm really curious. Sammy, you said several times that there are forces out there which are against any peace movement. What are we talking about? Economics, governments, military?
Well, what I'm talking about is that there's always mention of the extremists. There are extremists, and these extremists are on both sides, that the option of living together in peace and equality on the land is a no option for them. On the Israeli society, there are groups that fully believe that this land is land for Jews only, and God gave them this land, and nobody else is supposed to be on this land except Jews. And we witness this a lot with a big portion, not the entire, but a big portion of the settlers' movement in the West Bank, which is ideological. This is our land. We might be nice to allow the Arabs to be there for certain periods of time, but at the end of the day, this is for us, and nobody's supposed to be there except us. On the Palestinian side, there are also these groups as well that believe that this is historic Palestine, this is even Waqf land, religious Muslim land. And again, anybody who wants to be there has to be under that umbrella of the Muslim nation or the Waqf and so on. It's not to say that no Jews are allowed, because Jews have historically lived in Arab lands before, but it's under that system, which for many Jews is a system that they will not accept to be in. So this is why I said there are forces And I would say there are minority on both sides, but there are forces that, for them, the option of peace, which for me, living together in equality and respect on that land, doesn't matter what the borders look like, can be it one state or 10 states, is not the issue for me, but that Jews, Christians, and Muslims who live there, live together in equality, in the Holy Land, there are people that don't want that option.
You know, there are these weird little sects all around the world to do what's happening in Israel. I mean, all the hope in the world not going to do it. Somebody is funneling a whole lot of money and energy into those operations. And the settlers are not generating all the bombs that got dropped on Lebanon. You know, who's buying this, you know, who's buying the arms and ammunition that goes into Gaza?
Well, I mean, I think that it's an interesting, you know, there are a couple of different. You want me to say it? I'm sorry.
Sure. I'm really curious about it.
And I think it's important to sort of clarify, because one of the things Sammy and I have come across a lot are sort of, in some ways we are anticipating the question of extremists and anticipating it on the Muslim side. And so we want to, in some ways, it needs to be addressed exactly what it means on both sides. For me, and this is, you know, my opinion from my experience of the Israeli military, the Israeli governmental system, is that it just also so happens that extremists in Israel have a disproportionate amount of power within their own government than, for example, extremists on the Palestinian side. So that does make a difference in how those two, how the Israelis deal with and address extremism versus how Palestinians deal with and address extremism. You know, what are the numbers? You know, like, are there a higher percentage of extremists within Israeli society than extremists, quote unquote, within Palestinian society? I don't know. But I do know for sure that extremists within Israeli society have a disproportionate, and it's complicated and is based on the way their government is formed. It's about the Knesset. Many of us know that it's about how the parliamentary system, that a group, a political party of relatively small numbers have a disproportionate amount of power. So, but you raise, you know, a secondary question, maybe it's not secondary, maybe even more important, which is what allows those things to happen? What allows those, you know, the extremist elements within Israeli society or within Palestinian society to occur? And certainly on the Israeli side, it's because the American government funds it, and funds it a lot, in terms of direct military aid and also direct, you know, indirect aid and all that stuff. Is that kind of...
Well, Mr. Arafat, when he died, apparently that just went $20 billion.
Right.
I mean the stuff underneath this just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, let me, I mean, there... it is a complicated question, and there, you know, there is no direct answers. But I mean, even if we look at this, and again speaking on the Israeli side, one of the most powerful groups that is supporting and maintaining these activities and actions by Israeli extremists are not just the U.S. government or military or even the Israeli Jewish lobby here. There is a very strong organized group in the U.S. Won't be surprising when everybody knows who they are. It is the right American Christian Zionist groups that are very organized, very supportive, very engaging in the political process, very pressuring on the political leadership in the U.S., especially in Congress. And these voices of Christian fundamentalists are the ones who are really setting the agenda of U.S. policy in that region. And this is, for me, a group of people that is as much as you could get in terms of being anti-Semitic than anything on this earth. Because, you know, at the end of the day, what they're looking for is the destruction of the Jewish state of Israel. Their program, their agenda, their theology is one where they want to do this for the second coming of God. And the second coming of God, of Jesus, sorry, means that there are really no options for Jews. You either are killed or you convert to Christianity. So the options are pretty slim when you compare this, the two options for Jewish survival. But this is an ideology that is very powerful in the U.S. that has to be fought in a very hard way. And they are the ones that are, in my opinion, leading and setting up this extremism on the Israeli side. When they pulled out of South Lebanon, they were out protesting pulling out of South Lebanon. When Sharon pulled out of Gaza, Pat Robertson prayed for Sharon's death on TV. I mean, this is how extreme they are. So it's very complicated, but this is one component that has to also be addressed. And I would say on the other side, you know, we have to also see the political geography of the region and what is happening and how the Palestinian situation and issue is also being abused by certain leaders in the Middle East who are using and abusing the Palestinian right to struggle for liberation and self-determination for their own political and ideological agenda. And I would go from Iran to Morocco on this. Every time a leader wants, or every time an Arab or Muslim leader sees his popularity go down, including even bin Laden, who has nothing to do with us, every time their popularity go down, they just have to yell out the slogans that rally the cry of the Arabs and the Muslim world, which is Jerusalem, Al-Quds, the land, Palestine, and so on. And we have become sort of an act in their agenda. And this is why it's very important to resolve this issue. If Americans are worried about extremism, as it is called, and fundamentalism, as it is called, on both sides, the only way to deal with it is to achieve real peace in that part of the world.
Did you have your hand up over here?
I did. I was just going to say that it seems to me that the people in power who are benefiting economically from the situation as it is are the ones that always don't want peace. And so the roots of extremism among Israeli Zionists in terms of the Likud and its faith historically has always been there, and they got exactly what they want. They've done exactly what the U.S. did, which is, you know, the militant leaders of trade unions were bought off, and they did this whole thing of destroying the economy of the Kibbutz that used to be most of a lot of the agriculture, and, you know, going in a more super capitalist way. Now, you know, they used to have the smallest gap between rich and poor among Israeli Jews. Now it's like one of the widest in the world. So. It's not surprising, and some of us feel that in fact these things don't get solved outside of a whole broader context of reality until people unite across those lines, because, you know, divide and conquer is the way rulers always do things, and it's, you know, play the race card, play the religion card, get people all riled up. People don't know their own history, so they don't know.
When you were talking about your father growing up in the orphanage, it brought to mind that I read recently that there's a shutdown of the WAF orphanages in the northern West Bank.
In Hebron, southern, I'm not sure if it's also in the northern, but I know in Hebron, in the city of Hebron, which is a place that PSP works, there's been a shutdown of a couple of orphanages and schools in the city that the Israeli military came in with just orders of closure, saying that they were charities being run by Hamas, and so therefore were illegal institutions or illegal whatever. And there are actually some amazing stories of, and they haven't all been shut down. In fact, there's been a couple that the Israeli military has, there's a school, for example, that the Israeli military has given an order to shut down, that international activists, including people from the Christian peacemaker team, who are amazing, I sing their praises, and also some of the children and their parents are staying, sleeping day and night in the school to keep it open, to prevent because what happened was to the orphanages, the Israeli military came in and basically locked the doors and, you know, barred it from anybody coming in, and so they've been sort of sleeping in the school. So it's still, the struggle against that is still continuing now. As for why, as I said, the Israeli military claims that it's because, I think that, you know, politically speaking, it's in Israel's best interest, especially in places like Hebron, which are known as sort of being a bit more conservative, to break any sort of establishment that is beneficial to people that is linked to Hamas to, in order to discredit Hamas in the views of people that they, you know, does that make sense? Like, the fact that it's linked to Hamas is also just a, sort of a, an excuse that they're using to really undermine social services for people like orphans and kids.
I want to go back to earlier comment and the response that you made. We have a wall here too, a wall of oppression. And what I'm alluding to is that, as you indicated before, there's the Israel lobby. Well, according to what I've read, somewhere between 45% and 60% of all donations to the Democratic Party are contributed by Jews, and somewhat lesser percent to the Republican Party. AIPAC, which is just a small part of the whole Israel lobby network, has a budget of $100 million a year and hundreds of operatives, and they are, have their hands in everything. Mm-hmm. That's a big, huge wall, and I wonder what suggestions you would have for us who live here who have to try to confront that wall. What would you suggest that we do in order to try to erode the power of this organization and all of the terrible sorts of things that it has managed to do to disparage the Palestinian people and to provide a tremendous amount of pro-Israeli propaganda?
Mm-hmm. Very good question. And maybe Becky can also don't run away from this one. For me, there are things that, that can be done. And for me, it has always been that we should not actually engage in direct confrontation and conflict with AIPAC, because that for me only makes them stronger. There are alternatives that are coming out. There's J Street, for example. I haven't read much about it, but I've read some articles about this sort of new lobby effort that's coming out and is attracting many Jewish thinkers and believers in peace and quite affluent individuals within American Jewish society who are joining this counter to AIPAC. So creating a counter is one option. For me, the question is, it is not about how powerful and strong they are. It is what is causing American politicians to follow in whatever AIPAC tells them. They get actually minutes written for senators and Congress people to speak. And it's very interesting. There are stories actually about how reporters would go and interview a staunch, hardline liberal Democrat and a very conservative Republican, asking them the same questions and getting word for word the same exact answer from these speaking notes that are given to them by AIPAC. This is what you're supposed to say. This is what your people want you to say. It's not just what AIPAC wants you to say. This is what your constituents in your state, in Idaho, want you to say to these questions when you are asked. And they say them word for word. So it's across the line between Democrat and Republican. As everybody knows, it's always the same statement said on these issues. The challenge for us is how can we reach people who are in power? How can we reach those who are in Congress, those who are in the Senate, and show them that their own constituency have a different message than the ones they are hearing? And this is the best way to counter groups like AIPAC and to counter, which for me is even a stronger group, which is the Christian Zionist groups. For me, they are even stronger and much more influenced because they have a much greater constituency that they speak on behalf of than AIPAC does. And for me, on a personal level, I'm working now and starting to put a big effort in just dealing with the Christian church in the U.S. and how to change that view through a clear theological debate and understanding of how the theology that they are teaching their people is a wrong theology. And there are many Palestinian Christian leaders now who are now developing with American Christian leaders a real alternative, a clear theology that is starting to create a crack within the Christian Zionist movement. If you read reports and follow the news of the Christian Zionist movement, there is a small crack that is happening within that. Now, this crack is leading people like John Hagee to become even more extreme, where now there isn't a God but Israel as the God. I mean, this is almost exactly what he's saying. But even there are some evangelical churches that are saying, we're tired of this, this doesn't make sense, and we will change about this. The challenge is, again, how to reach senators and congresspeople. And for me, the only way to do this is not only through the letter writing and the faxing and the emails and the telephone. It is by communities engaging in action in their own community, action that actually makes it to the evening news and the newspapers. Because every congressperson who lives anywhere from, or is from any state and lives in Washington, D.C., the first thing their aides do every morning is look at their local newspapers and see what is happening in their local community, because this is what makes them make their decisions, because ultimately, you know, they're looking only for one thing, which is re-election. Every senator, congressperson, no matter how right or left they are, they will sell their mother to get re-elected. And I have been told this by a strong Israeli supporter, Republican, conservative senator. He said, I will switch like this on Israel when I see my constituency saying switch. But now Israel is a win-win issue for them. They it's not to say Israel. They say Israel and they win. If you don't say Israel, actually you lose. Now you say Israel and you win. But Obama is saying Israel, you know, Barack Obama, Clinton, what's the third guy? McCain. you know, they're all three of them are on the national 60-year anniversary committee for Israel. All three of them are members of that national committee, because Israel is a win-win thing for them, because the constituency are not saying anything. If people start going out, again, it's not writing letters, it's demonstrating actions, activities that make it to the local press, some change will start happening there. By doing it, and maybe we have...
To that, you know, we need to be strategic about what needs to happen. I mean, I just think we've lost strategy in our movements and in our, you know, we certainly have in the House, you know, a lot of things. I think we've lost a lot of thinking about what are we trying to accomplish and how do we get there most directly, and then what do we not need to do? What doesn't need to happen in order to get there? So maybe, you know, our immediate thought, you know, with the aid casting, for example, the immediate thought is to create but, you know, the thought of creating an alternative lobby, well, you know, that might be okay. We should think about how, what the strategy is of that, and, you know, what our ultimate goal is. I'm not sure that creating a, you know, a dovish yet purely, you know, pro-Israel lobby is the way to address the issue. I'm not sure that, you know, the next time, you know, that might be fine for now, but for in a couple of years when something, the dynamic changes, you're still going to end up with two pro, you know, two lobbies that are purely interested in advocating for another country within our government, you know, that's prospect. But for me, it's about, you know, how do we change the environment in our country? See, I think that it's much easier to move grassroots than it is to move leaders. I just kind of think that's true, like in general. I think that leaders tend to be the last one to figure it out. You know, so I think that it's easier to think about how we change the environment in the United States and in our communities that allows people to think that it is that political suicide. This is the term I've heard all week. It's political suicide for somebody to not be pro-Israel. Obama secretly is pro-Palestinian, but he can't say it, and he's careful because it's political suicide to come out in any criticism whatsoever against Israel. That might be true, but my point is how do we change the environment that makes that true? Because that is something we can do. It is, there is something you can do about, you know, that's simply about voting. That's simply about numbers. You know, it might, somebody's taking an example about money, but that's a larger political issue. You know, if we want to talk about how elected officials are really much more influenced by donations than by actual votes, well, you all deal with that. But I was over there. But, you know, I think that is something that we can.
Yes.
The Methodists and Presbyterians are, as you probably know, about to tackle selective divestment. And I want to suggest that you can go online to Jewish Voice for Peace. And there's really this fabulous website, Invest for Peace, I think is what it's called. And if you run a map or something, you can take a picture of yourself. It's just a fabulous website. And write a little paragraph or put your picture, and you can let the Presbyterians know and the Methodists know that you support selective investment. That's something that you can do when you go home on your computer. And that the divestment movement is one of those cross places, and we can really get the Presbyterians and Methodists to go in that direction. That would be a major step forward. Selective divestment without going into the whole history of it is a very narrow and specific focus on four, based on a model of South Africa. I'm saying that this is what they are doing right now. Okay, I'm not going to get into a conversation about the whole politics, right? So right now, the Presbyterians and the Methodists are considering, that's what they are doing. They are considering selective divestment on Caterpillar and Motorola as a friend. So whether, you know, without having a whole conversation about the legal occupation and so forth, talking about steps forward and creating strategies to make, you know, push change forward, this is an immediate opportunity to push a church community that has, I think the Methodists have 40,000 and the Presbyterians have lots and lots and lots of thousands, and they are about to make this decision, and this is a way for us to help support them to make that decision. The other conversation is an important conversation to have. Absolutely.
General conversation that is going on right now, too.
It's going on right now in Texas, so you get online right now. you can help, because JPP is handing them lists of people and their faces and their patients. Every morning they're going to be handing them a list, like a scroll, and the longer that scroll is, the more supportive they'll be, because if we're ever going to get to that other place, there's steps to go along the way, and this is a good way to get there. What, you know, possible way to get there.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, can you give us an address to send checks to?
Yeah. We have a brochure. I think we have more brochures in the back. If you could raise.
Nothing. I think this, yeah, this brochure in the back, we have a U.S. address.
Well, online, yeah. I mean, we have that full technology of PayPal and all of that stuff as well online that people can also send the donations to. Thank you.
In the red?
Yes.
A little louder.
I actually helped to bring your uncle and also a couple of speakers from Bandeja and Tampa over to the Randy County to talk. And I've been following these people in the league, and well, somewhat, they had mixed success. And they've been at their demonstrations for a very long time now, and really have little to show for it. How can you keep up the morale when there's so little to show for all their
nonviolent efforts? Yeah. Well, engaging in nonviolence is never easy. And what I said before is that I cannot actually stand here and declare that we have a nonviolent movement. We don't. We have pockets of communities that are engaging in nonviolent resistance, and most of it is because they're living the situation now. I mean, there is no other option but to do something or to surrender completely to it. What we are seeking is to go beyond that, which is into developing a mass, popular, nonviolent movement, like Becca said, where every single Palestinian individual is involved. The greatest majority of Palestinians now are not involved in any form of resistance. Nothing. They're doing absolutely nothing instead, except sitting in their homes, complaining about how bad the situation is. So what we need is to how to empower and mobilize and bring hope to this great majority, great power that we have, to mobilize it for nonviolence, to mobilize it to engage in resistance. And there are many missing components of this. We, for example, one missing important component to engage in this is to have leadership committed to this. So now we have the leadership at the local level. We have the leadership in the villages who are very committed to nonviolence, but for them they're committed to deal with that particular issue that they face. So we need to develop a unified national leadership committed to engaging in nonviolence. And the biggest obstacle for developing this leadership is not Israel, it is the Palestinian leadership itself. Because even though our leadership talks about nonviolence and our president mentions nonviolence every third or fourth speech that he gives, you can't just talk about it. You have to engage in it. You have to be actively involved. We want to see the president actually come to Bilayin and participate in an action against the wall. This is what we want to see our president do. Not sit in Ramallah and just talk about it. So part of it is having leadership. Part of it is also developing a real strategy for nonviolence. It is not about tomorrow is Friday, today is Thursday, what are we going to do tomorrow? It is about developing a nationwide strategy where you start analyzing and understanding what are, you know, the term in strategic thinking is called the pillars of support that maintain the structures of the occupation. So it's not the idea of resisting the occupation, it's resisting what maintains the occupation alive against us. What are these pillars? And we talked about some of them today here. I mean, about the Zionist Christian influence in the U.S., the Israeli lobby. These are all pillars of support in this country that have to be addressed. Over there, the military, the policies, the structures of obedience that have been created by the army for Palestinians. The checkpoints are a pillar that supports the occupation. So how do we develop specific strategies to confront the checkpoints, for example? So it's a long process of building. You know, this is, I mean, it's engaging in it as if you are really engaging in a war. This is a war. And the only thing different between what we want to do and what happens in real war is just the weapons that are used. But 70% of what happens in a war and in training soldiers has nothing to do with weapons. It's about building strategy, it's about building resiliency, it's about building confidence in the soldier, it's about the training process that takes place with the soldier. It's not the training where, again, sitting in a circle with a board and writing, you know, points of what nonviolence is. It is about, in a real sense, developing an army that is nonviolent and will engage in this strategy. So there's a lot of things that are missing in this. As I said, we still have a long way to go, but at least we're seeing a shift in a desire to learn and a minimizing of criticism of nonviolence within the Palestinian community. And learning is where everything begins.
Sammy, we have time for one more question.
And maybe if it's a short one, we'll...
Well, I have a short question. In regard to leadership, in regard to the movement that you'd like to see created, in regard to the army that you'd like to form, India had Gandhi, the United States had Martin Luther King. These men symbolized something, and they drew millions to them. Do you see on the horizon a Palestinian equivalent of these men?
The challenge that I always say is not in having as individuals. There are many situations around the world where it was movements and groups of individuals that were the leadership. In the first Intifada, we had an underground committee made up of all the different factions that were committed to working together in one vision. And it didn't matter if they were Hamas, Fatah, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, they all work together in one vision and in achieving one goal. The question that I actually ask more is not who is our Gandhi, but the question is what is our salt?
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows the salt march. And when Gandhi was strategic and smart enough to pick salt as the target of his big protest, that is the question. So what is our salt becomes more important than asking who is our Gandhi.
Although you may need a Gandhi to figure out where the salt is.
We need many people to think. You know, when Gandhi developed the salt march, many people think that, you know, people don't know. It's not they think. They don't know that it took him 6 months. 6 months of thinking and meditation and preparation and building strategy, going through many scenarios in his mind with many people, 6 months to come up with salt. So he knew what he was doing because it took time. So this is what we need. We need thinkers who are able to build strategies, who are able to put all the emotions aside, which is very important, and to be able to also determine that the action that they will do will also be perceived as a non-threatening action by the other side, which is very important.
Did you want to add a comment to that question?
Oh, no, I was just saying that I think that any of us have the ability to figure out what our fault is. I think that for too long, people wait for leaders to, for a leader either to emerge or for the leaders that exist to set up the program. I think that we're wanting to have that. And I have lots of faith in people, and I have friends with them.
One last quick question.
Okay. Mine's a very grassroots question. It seems like, you know, people here are quite enlightened, and I'm Jewish, and I'm from a family where my mother is a concentration camp survivor, and her favorite cousin was killed by a suicide bomber. She was in Jerusalem. And my mother is very understanding, compassionate, open-minded, and she doesn't want to see Israel doing the same thing to the Palestinians, so, you know, what she experienced. But most of my relative, when I bring up very tentatively my feelings about the subject, you know, say, well, they want to push us into the ocean, they, you know, or they teach hatred in their schools, you know, and I need like some baby things that I can give people to open up their minds, like the story of your family. And the only thing I know is the movie Encounter Point. But I'm wondering, you know, is there a book or just something for people who need their first step in understanding?
And the other thing I say in terms of books, Phyllis Dennis.
That's what AFSC's office exists for.
Yeah.
And there is one terrific starting booklet back on the table there, Truth Versus Truth by Ariadne Mary. Did you want to make some suggestions, Becca?
I was just going to say the one that I gave my dad is by Tanya Reinhart, so it's an Israeli professor. She was an Israeli professor at Columbia University, which is a fair amount of credit. She wrote two books, but the one that I used called Israel, Palestine, How to End the War from 1948. And it's small, it's accessible, 130 pages, it's like seven stories pressed, but it really starts from the beginning. And in her introduction, she says, you know, the birth of Israel was a state that was birthed out of sin, and I think I could have lived with that if it had ended there. And then goes and talks about what happened and the policies of Israel and Palestine since then. And she's not very good, you know, she's very historical about it, she's a linguist and whatever. But it's accessible and it's not beat over the head. It's written by an Israeli. She clearly has Israeli friends and family, so I think that often can.
May I ask a hand for our speakers this evening? If any of you are not on the AFSC Middle East mailing list, it doesn't mean you'll get on the list for every program that we have. But if you're not on, be sure you put your name down. There is a little bit of selected literature back there. The less I have to carry out of the car, the better, so let's talk about it.
And also, I'm going to put up there, Palestine Solidarity Project has an email where we, unless there's an emergency, send one email a month with all of our reports of what we're doing, what's been happening in the Hebron district, with part news, part activism stuff. So I'll put a piece of paper out that says that, and you can put your
While Beth is doing that, if you'll be patient enough for one more announcement.
Sorry.
We have a series coming up which will begin May 14th. At Tehillah Synagogue on confronting Islamophobia and anti-Semitism as two sides of the same coin. It's very hard to talk about the two together, but they are each equal aspects of racism in our society and around the world. We hope that you'll sign up for it. There are a number of brochures back on the table. You're welcome to take 5, 10, 20, post them up, share them with the groups that you're active with, and call up the AFSC office to tell Lynn or Nora or myself that you're going to be coming. But most of all, on behalf of AFSC and the Berkeley Friends Church, I want to thank each and every one of you for coming. I hope you found it stimulating, and any ideas you have to make it more stimulating or to get more people to the next program, just give us a call or an email, and we'll be very grateful. Thank you all.
Thank you.